All right, so it is 7 o'clock. It is time to start our webinar. I am so excited about the session. This is something that derived really out of our journal club that we had last month. We had opened up the journal club for the across the ultrasound community. And one of the things we wanted to figure out is how do we actually get started in research? How do you identify a good study? How do you identify your niche? And we had an amazing panel to start this off, and there was a need for just more dedication to this aspect of the arena. And that led to the development of this ASEP Research Learning Series. This is the first of several sessions. We have two upcoming sessions, one on November 11th called Breaking Down Study Designs. It's going to talk about pros, cons, common flaws amongst different types of study designs. And then another one on February 17th called From Idea to Publication, It's Strategies for Publishing and Navigating the Peer Review System. That's going to be led by different types of expert researchers, editors, peer reviewers, who are going to lend their insights as well. And so for today's session, it's entitled Finding Your Niche and Identifying Successful Studies. We have an amazing panel of Dr. Pavitra Kotini Shah, Dr. Joseph Ray, Dr. Lori Stoltz, and Dr. Felipe Turan. Amongst the four of them, they're going to talk today as an open Q&A. We have a series of questions we've already started to collect for them, but I want you as the audience to weigh in as well. As you have questions, send it to us. We're going to ask our experts. This is an amazing opportunity, an hour with leading researchers. We're going to share all their pearls, pitfalls, and lessons learned. So please feel free to send any and all questions directly to me, and I'll help integrate them into the session. And so with that being said, maybe our panelists could just briefly kind of introduce yourself, and then we'll kind of go from there. And we'll start off with Pavitra.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I am an assistant professor of emergency medicine at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I'm also the assistant fellowship director for the ultrasound fellowship. Currently, I'm an NIH Birch Scholar, which stands for Building Interdisciplinary Research Careers in Women's Health. So I'm, I guess, a developing physician scientist.
Excellent. And then Joe?
Hi, my name is Joe Perry. I'm at Boston University, and our affiliated hospital is Boston Medical Center. I'm also, I am assistant fellowship director here, and I'm currently also serving as the director of ultrasound research for our division.
Great, and then we'll go next to Lori. Oh, actually to Felipe Tempera.
And I'm Felipe Tran. I'm an emergency medicine physician trained, ultrasound trained. Is spent 5 years at Penn and just left the division of emergency ultrasound there to join a new shop here in New York City at Cornell. So I'm currently at Weill Cornell Medicine, where I'm an assistant professor in the emergency department, and I've actually taken a research position. So I'm slightly changing paths, which might be relevant to today's discussion, and trying to dive in a bit more into the sort of research side of things, of course, within emergency medicine. So that's my pot.
Excellent. And looks like Dr. Lori Stoltz is temporarily having some internet difficulties. As soon as she joins back in, we'll have her introduce herself as well. In the interim, we start with maybe the first and most important question about finding your niches. Why should we care? Why do we want to develop a niche?
Do you want me to go? Okay. I'll start it off, I guess. I think so. Why is it important to develop a niche? I think having a niche is important if you're serious about research, especially. So I recently heard an analogy that really resonated with me, and I thought I'd share it with you guys. So it was the analogy is essentially, it's helpful to kind of think of your career as kind of a book with a particular, say per se, a theme, right? Or a topic. And each chapter of your book could be about like an aspect of that overarching topic or theme. And each chapter could represent about 5 years. honestly, the first chapter may end up spanning about 7 years, especially if you're starting a family or maybe encounter a pandemic, right? But that's kind of the essential thing, right? So to have like a theme that kind of ties everything together on paper, it's super important. So when you write your NIH bio sketch and you're applying for grants, that's what they want to see, that you have skin in the game in a particular area and that you're somewhat of a content expert. So, so that's important for academic productivity. And then I would say just even as part of a group or part of your department, like all of us as ER physicians, we're jack of all trades, right? But it's nice to be known for like something. Like I like to be referred to as the ultrasound resuscitation sex differences expert. So I think though that's kind of why having a niche is important.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you definitely summed up a lot of great aspects, Pavitra, about why you want to be a specialist in an area. I would add a couple more as well. So most of us who do research are at academic institutions, primarily because of the associated resources and able to conduct research. And as you think about wanting to maybe progress your career and academic advancement as well, and you start thinking about progressing from instructor to assistant to full professor down the road, having that niche and really defining yourself as a content expert within both the you know, the national platform and then progressing to an international platform is really important. And if you're spread out too wide, it can be really hard to become that one expert in that one area to be able to help grow your CV and know that. And the other thing I would add is sort of as getting into research, it can be a little bit overwhelming thinking about all the different study designs. And if you develop one research niche or area that you can sort of start to develop for understanding how to perform research and the steps it takes to be successful, for example, being familiar with like the STARD or other guidelines, so that way, every time you go in to do a project, you're not learning it from scratch and can be a little bit more efficient that way is one way. As you start to develop your research portfolio and learn more skills and capabilities to be able to expand your skills and niche.
I love it. You guys hit on a lot of really great pearls out of this one. The first one is just, you know, having your vision, your overall overarching career plan, and, you know, Pavitra highlighted the idea of here's your kind of your chapters of your book as you go along your career. And some things may deviate you along that, but like, where's your end goal? Where do you want to be? How do you want to close the chapter and how do you want to close the book of your career and your in that portion of your life? I love the idea also of, you know, developing your expertise, both from a promotion standpoint. You know, a lot of times when you look at full professors, it's you are a national or an international expert in this. And the more that you have that kind of this in place, the more you're known as the blank person, the easier it is to define that role, the easier it is to also be recruited for talks and different opportunities because they know that you do this arena. The idea for those who are doing, who are looking for grant funding, it's much easier to have a biosketch when it's a clear focus versus a, I did one project and another. There's a whole portion of the biosketch that's devoted to show me the areas you've advanced science. And the more that you can have that series of linked studies, the more competitive you'll be for grants. So it has that feed forward mechanism. And the last one is probably one of my favorites is research efficiency. When you have to continually look up a brand new process, a brand new arena of research, it's so much more work than if you just went ahead and said, all right, for me to write an airway paper is much easier than for me to take a new topic because I know the literature, I've written on it before. It's much easier when you sit in that house. I could write an introduction very quickly. For me to do, you know, a brand new paper is just such a massive amount of work to relearn that subject that there's a lot of, you know, again, feed forward benefits. So we understand niches definitely are important. There's a lot of value in them. What's your niche and how did you actually identify it? How did you develop it and how did it change? Libby, Lori, maybe one of you guys want to take a stab at this one for the next one.
I can't say that I was very directed in my developing of a niche. And I would have to say that I have a lot to learn from others in our field about narrowing your niche enough. Because I would say that mine kind of fell into my lap because I did international like global health trips many times as a medical student, as a resident, and then again as a fellow. And then because of that work, it was then an automatic niche that was kind of handed to me. And then other niches also have been, it's not as though I went out and said, you know, this is what I'm really interested in, because I think as a young attending, you're very interested in many things and working on the projects that are readily available to you. And then building upon that was the most successful path that I found.
I completely agree with all the points. And same as Lori describes, I feel like I'm myself still learning every day about how to kind of navigate this path. By no means I have everything figured out when it comes to research or your career. But I think from my perspective, and I've spent some time thinking about niche and how niche is needs to be kind of intentional and kind of what role has in my career and my research, not just in the research, which is kind of what we're talking about, but more broadly career-wise. And the reasons why I think niche are important, at least the way I see it, is because I think in order to succeed at anything, you need a strategy. You can't just have a goal, you need a strategy. And niche is necessary to have a strategy. You have to be able to define well, what is it that you are going to do and how is it that you're going to do it? So strategy is a kind of intimately related concept that I think is important and supports why niche is important career-wise. The other second concept that in my mind is really also closely related is purpose. I've had the fortune to be mentored by incredible mentors in my short career. And one thing that I've learned about all of them, a common denominator of sort, is that they all have a very clear purpose in their careers. So I've spent some time trying to learn about what is it, that purpose? What is this thing that kind of gets people up in the morning to work really hard and produce work of great quality? So there's been some work in the psychology literature about purpose and like kind of what are the components, sort of the formula. This guy, Richard, later wrote a book about it. And he says that purpose is basically equals to gifts plus passion plus values. You might say, what the heck does this to do with niche? I think that identifying your purpose is really somehow intimately related to your niche, because you want to understand what is it that you enjoy, that you feel sort of this internal drive, so that then you can go and kind of work on that thing. And that thing can be something as specific as a topic, as a disease entity. Pavitra and myself both shared interest in cardiac arrest resuscitation, but it doesn't have to be just an entity or a disease. It could be a methodology. It could be a kind of an approach. I think Mike Gottlieb is a great example of that. It would be hard to say what is Mike's Gottlieb's area of expertise. He's a damn expert of, you know, a long list of things. And so his expertise, his niche, is this kind of craft, which is a combination of certain diseases, ultrasound, and then methodologies. He's just really good at enabling processes. In my case, I think the way I translate passion and sort of the purpose in my career and how they relate to niche is that the concept that how I think about it is intrinsic motivation. There's a guy that I think Carl Newport wrote about intrinsic motivation and sort of broke it down in three components. Why intrinsic what is it that gives us intrinsic motivation? The one is autonomy. The other one is competence. And the other one is relatedness. So autonomy is why we need a niche. When you have a niche, you get more autonomy. You get more control over your time of how you do things. When you have a niche, it's easier to become competent, to become a master, to become better at what you do, because you're dedicated time to that one specific thing that is well-defined. And relatedness is basically connecting with other people in the process. When you have a niche, you are able to connect with people to find sort of a tribe in that whatever you do. In ultrasound, we go on, you know, conferences, and depending on the niche, you meet people within that niche, within that realm. And then there's, I think, something really powerful about sharing that sort of experience with those people that share whatever niche you have. You know, Pavitra and I hang out at resuscitation conferences that have nothing to do with ultrasound, where we have a network of people that are all passionate about this area.
Can I add something onto what Philippe said? You know, you talk about your intrinsic motivation and, you know, building upon opportunities that you have, and having kind of your strategy. And that really rang true. One of the things that I always, one of my biggest mentors is Srikar Takari, who's his fellow. And he always forces all of his fellows to, whatever you do, study it. And I think that goes along with what you were saying. Because if you are going to be doing something, you obviously have an intrinsic desire to fix that thing or address that thing. And then it is then informing your strategy. It's building a strategy that you can then take forward into the rest of your career. And it furthers your promotion package in all of the administrative and operational ways, in addition to the research aspect too. But I thought it tied in well with what you were saying.
I just want to add that I so 100% agree with what Felipe said and what Lori just seconded. So much good stuff there, what you guys just mentioned. And it kind of answers one of the question. I think one of the ways to get at the strategy, right, or to define your vision when you are a young faculty and you're trying to figure out what that is a lot of introspection that Felipe referred to, right? Like, so it's not something we're necessarily taught in, certainly not, you know, medical school, even residency, or even post, you know, graduate training. So I think it's about taking that time to like put your pen to paper and have some of that time to reflect and define yourself, kind of get to know who you are, taking a bird's eye view. I think that's a strategy that can be helpful in defining what your career path, your strategy might be.
I think also becoming within this three components that I mentioned, competence is something that I've learned, that I've thought about a lot, and I'm sure you have too. And it's so difficult, right, to become competent and to become master of like your craft. And I feel like it's critical to each one of us, regardless of kind of what your values are, I think, to have to feel fulfilled. In order to feel fulfilled, you need to be good at what you do. And you might measure, you know, each of us might measure different sort of, you know, performance, or how is it that you define when are you good or when are you good enough? But whatever measure you have personally, I think it's good. I think it's important to have personally the sense that you are good at what you're doing. And it's obviously harder to get to that feeling and have that sort of impression that you are good at what you do when you are doing a lot of very different, unrelated things. And so I think each one of us, by going into ultrasound fellowship or whatever other fellowship is that you do, is sort of, to some extent, intuitively pursuing that as well, pursuing that craftsmanship, kind of that area of excellence that we can more realistically and feasibly achieve. Not everybody is like Mike Oldley.
I think one of the things that's kind of fascinating is I'm listening to the different stories there. You have almost two different ways of getting to the same, of getting to their niche, right? We have Lori's example where went through global health and kind of just fell into this niche. And then you have Felipe's example, where he's like, I plotted this out and I had a very specific strategy of how I was going to get there. And it almost, I feel like, you know, that's where features come out with really resonate with me, is you can end up in the same point different ways, but the introspection, that reflection, that thinking back on how you got there, the things you liked, the things that drove you there, are how I feel like to some degree you start to figure out your niche. You may know from right off the bat, this is what I want to do, and you may have your trajectory, or you may not. You may still be figuring out along the way, but if you don't pause, right, to quote Ferris Bueller poorly, if you don't stop, take a moment, you're going to miss, life's going to pass you by. If you don't take that moment to reflect on your career and your niche and what you like doing, I think we miss that opportunity to find our niche. And that's how we find ourselves just doing things for the sake of doing them, instead of doing things that are going to help us to be more satisfied, more competent in our skills, and more just enjoying that area of research. There's a question that came up from the audience of, it seems like there's a push and a pull where you want to have your own purpose, but if you're focused on that, it can translate can translate to not saying yes to fantastic opportunities. So do you have advice, especially for those early in their careers, how to keep an open mind, but continue pushing your vision?
I guess to sort of answer this, or how I would in my way, I think it's really hard because you're going to want to say yes, because you want to be a yes person. You want to be collaborative. You don't want to miss out on opportunities you're later going to regret because, it was an outstanding experience. It's hard knowing that going into it, what you're turning down until sometimes afterwards. But knowing ideally what the requirements are going to be, how much time it's going to take, what it's going to take away from what you want to get done, and then also what you're going to get out of it. So even if you may end up being a middle author or, a contributor at another site that's not going to give you first or last author publication, if you learn something about how to now conduct methods or enroll patients or do a multi-site study and that's important to you, then that may be worth the effort. If you end up having to enroll a ton of patients individually on your own and you get a middle author publication in an area that's not really, an area that you are particularly interested in, but you say yes because you know it's going to be a publication, that may not be worth it. But with that being said, if you're not super busy or you're looking to get your feet wet and want to see what things are like, those sorts of opportunities where you're not particularly the person who's leading the charge can be a good way to start to get involved if that's what you're looking for.
Those are like super awesome practical points, Joe, that I think you just mentioned. I guess I would just add, if you have mentors that you've established, then actually just talking it through with your mentors and even the person who's providing you this opportunity, right? Keeping it real with them to be like, listen, is this really fitting for me? What do you think? And on a more philosophical level, even, I think can help you make that decision.
One of the things in that question is telling, right? They say, say yes to a fantastic opportunity. That means that in your mind, what was offered is fantastic. And it is okay to say no to something that you maybe started and then set it down. I mean, everything that you say yes to is a no to something else. Your time is limited. You want to be able to go do all of the things outside of work also. We don't want to be sacrificing our lives to our jobs. So the fact that somebody would say it's a fantastic opportunity tells me that's probably the one that you should invest in. And after you do your due diligence, Amika Vitra, that's a really good point, because sometimes what I think is a fantastic opportunity when I have somebody more experienced or with a different perspective can weigh in and say, that might not be worth the grind. And then the last piece to that is like, even the things that I have like set down and because I wanted to say yes to something else, it is definitely worth it to maybe put it on a slow path. This is terrible and you guys make fun of me, but I just recently published one of the papers from my fellowship. We're like a decade out now. And it was a breach delivery for sure. Because I hated it. I did the project as a fellow for lack of anything better. And I really disliked what I did, but for straight up perseverance purposes, it just got published. Don't read it. It's terrible.
I'm going to look it up right now. I have actually a kind of a pragmatic vision about this question, or at least the way I think about it feels practical to me. One of my mentors is Scott Weingard, and he does a lot of things, obviously. But he's actually, I think, someone that would be fair to define as someone who has a very, very well-defined niche that goes beyond one disease, right? It's an area of work, you could say. One of the things that I learned from him is the way he decides which projects to take on, which I know that is a problem that we all at some point and to some extent have difficulty with kind of triaging and deciding. And the sort of the formula that he follows that he recommended to me was to ask three questions every time that there's a new project or, you know, a fantastic opportunity. Does it advance my career plan? And so in order to answer that question, you have to have a career plan or some form of it. Does it align with your roadmap professionally, academically? So that's the number one. Number two, does it serve your well-being or the well-being of your family? That is, for instance, something that just makes you really happy or something that will make you, you know, that will make money for you, for instance. And then the third is it good for the world, basically? Great example, you know, you might not be interested in infectious diseases, but a lot of us jumped on COVID research doing COVID and put a hold on our work that was, you know, more important to advance our careers. And that's because it was the right thing to do for the world, for the specialty, for the field, for, you know, for medicine. I find those three kind of elements really helpful to kind of just triage projects and sort of determine what things make sense. And so to answer the question or to try to answer the question that somebody asked, how do you, you know, kind of determine when to stay focused and when to go sort of not let pass opportunities? I think an opportunity can be fantastic for someone else or can look fantastic and not necessarily make sense for your career. And that's where I've identified, at least in the you know, limited time that I've had to work with mentees, with residents or people that I've had the opportunity to sort of look at their career plans, for instance, like ultrasound fellows, I've been surprised by how many people just don't have a career plan at all. And the thing that I say is you're investing too much money to not have a career plan. You're leaving money on the table by staying in academics. If you were working for a private group, you're probably making 30% more salary. That would be more money for your family and for your, you know, future descendants. So you're investing money to go in academics. You better have a damn good reason. And I think you should have a plan. And that plan should be, I think, somewhat specific and include somewhere what are the things that are important to advance your career, specifically in research. I think another reason why a niche is important is because in the grantmanship game, in the grants game, which is unfortunately the bottom line, if you want to do funded research, grant reviewers will look for a story in your bio sketch or in your CV. They will look for a story that tells them that you are trustworthy, that you are someone that will actually deliver on the proposal that you're saying that you will complete. And the one of the things that they look for is what is it that you've done with, you know, your career until now? Have you been working on the, you know, the foundation of what you're saying that you would like to do? If you haven't, if this has just occurred to you one day, it's less likely than that someone will trust you, especially with a lot of money over multiple years. I think that's a very pragmatic also reason to have a niche, to be able to tell that story in your bio sketch that says, this is what I've cared about over the last 3 years, and I've done this much work towards that kind of area of knowledge.
I think there's just so many really, really amazing points built into there. I think one of the first things that resonated with me is just define what you mean by fantastic. It's a fantastic opportunity to you or to someone else, and being okay that, you know, pubs are useful, publications are useful, but that probably isn't the best end goal. It should be something that is valuable to you, whether it's advancing your career, serving your well-being, or, you know, is it good for the world? It might be the opportunity to expand your research network and develop a research, you know, connection. It might be the opportunity to learn new methodology or gain some experience in an arena, but there should be something that's valuable to you beyond the publication. Because if we're just chasing numbers, that's not going to be fulfilling in any capacity. I also really like the idea of just having your mentors, and, you know, I say mentors being plural because we should all have series of mentors, not just one, but having your mentors you go to, and some of them may be the ones who are saying, this is a good project and here's why, but some of them are the people who just know you and say, listen, Mike, I know you, I know this is a good opportunity, but in your current state, I don't think this would be valuable to you. And being able to be an external vision, because introspection is helpful, but sometimes it's helpful to be coached through the things we may just be blinded to. And I think the last thing, just being okay with saying no, there's an opportunity cost to everything we do. And, you know, it could be a great, fantastic opportunity, but if we say yes to this, then we may miss a much better or more fitted opportunity for us downstream. And I think that kind of leads me a little bit into the next question, which is, do you think it's possible to have more than one niche? And how many are too many?
So,
volunteers.
I guess I could start. I do think that it is possible to have more than one niche. And I don't think I have an answer to how many are too many, because at least some of the talks and leadership conferences I've been to, and you know, people have said repeatedly, and most well-renowned that we would all know by Dr. Nate Cooperman, you know, he constantly says, you know, you have to essentially reinvent yourself every 5 years, or that's one of his like pieces of advice. So I would say that I think every 5 years you may need to develop another niche or a sub niche or like an aspect of the niche that you're going to further develop. So I think over time during your career span, yes, I think you will develop multiple niches, but I don't know of what others think in terms of what would be too many.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a set number. And I also think it depends on the niche that you picked. You might find that, you know, what you picked 5 years ago is now being sort of like phased out, which is why I agree. I think it's probably a good idea to think about reinventing yourself and pivoting or changing or growing in new directions, to also push yourself in different ways. And so you don't get bored and reinvigorate what's interesting to you. So, you know, I think it depends on the individual and where they want to go in their career and what they've set up as their, you know, their career path and trajectory. And I totally agree. It's really important to have one of those, because it is a lot of investment that you're putting into an academic career if that's the direction you want to go in. And speaking with your mentors and getting advice and, you know, saying, am I spread too thin? Am I doing too much? Am I not doing enough? And some of that will come from external pressures from either your division or your chairhead. And if you do too much and you're not meeting deadlines, that's usually a sign that you need to step back and, you know, narrow a little more.
You know, one thing that, rather than defining how many that you have, especially at the fellowship stage, I think it's very helpful to, and this kind of goes in with what you were saying earlier about your strategy, but actually writing down what you would like your niches to be as a fellow, right? Like, some things may work and other things may not. What you thought was awesome may not pan out, but writing them down in ordinal order, that, you know, first I do this, next I do this, and next I do this. Then when opportunities come along, you know how to prioritize yourself. When deadlines are due, you know how to prioritize yourself. And then as you do your yearly strategic plan, you know, we all have to fill out these annual reviews. It's the perfect time to force yourself to update your CV, see how you're doing in each one of these arenas, and say, is that one really working out for me? Is this actually feeding my soul? Is it feeding my career? And should I demote that one and let my secondary sing this time? I think that rather than defining how many you do is put yourself in ordinal order, because then you won't end up a scattered mess. And you, as a, when you're building yourself and you're young, you don't have the opportunity to say, well, I mean, I think maybe Dr. Tehran did from the very beginning say, I'm going to do TEE. And then he just flew with it. But maybe not. But most of the time, we don't come out of the gates knowing exactly what we want to do. I think that's rare.
What's interesting, I completely agree with you, Lori. And what's interesting, actually, someone, Rosemary Thomas wrote, it's interesting, I thought ultrasound was the niche I picked. Turns out I needed to define a niche even in that. And I think I completely agree with that. And I think this is important. It's an important point. I don't have the answer to the question of how many niches can you have. So I'm going to answer it with another question, which is, do we know what a niche or what a sufficient niche is? And I think I do have at least some ideas about what things are not a niche. I think very often residents go into fellowships thinking that that area of specialization will be their niche. And ultrasound is a great example. Maybe at some point in medicine, emergency medicine, being an ultrasound expert was enough. And let's just be objective now. Let's just be even more pragmatic. It was enough to get a good academic position. In 2021, there's way too many people. So you will be put against a number of people with ultrasound fellowships. So then having an ultrasound fellowship, no longer enough to be a differentiator. So then that shouldn't really be enough for a niche. Same with medical education fellowship. I remember very vividly my program director, Kaushal Shah at Sinai, one of my mentors as well. He's a medical education guy with a great and sort of very successful career. He is med ed is his thing, as many program directors, but he's got also our other areas of expertise. Trauma is one of them. And so he's published on that. He gave a very specific advice to our group when we're graduating, which was many of us in our group were going into medical education. And I was sort of interested in that idea at that point. And somebody said, I want to just be, he asked the question. I think the context was, we're simulating you're interviewing for a job with a chair. And the chair is asking, what is your trick? What do you bring to the table? And this is, I think, a very real question. This is exactly how this goes. Maybe not in this terms, but that's kind of, you get the idea. So when the chair will ask you, what is it that you do? The answer of that resident at that point was, I'm a medical education expert. And Kaushal's point there was, well, that's not enough. Like, what is it within medical education that you do better than most people? What is it that would, what is it specifically that you bring to the table? And I think is applicable to any of the other fields that you choose. So in ultrasound, I think within ultrasound, you probably want to define what is within emergency ultrasound, your specific area. I'm a researcher. It's probably also not a niche. Within research, there's different types of research and sort of research at different levels. I think identifying kind of what category you want to fit in is good in a way that I've found helpful to do that, which might seem some sort of esoteric and kind of intangible, is to look at other people and, for instance, your mentors, and say, I want to do what they do. I want to be like him, like her, like that. I would like to have a career that looks like Michael lives, and do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, have time to play golf on Wednesdays, have time to spend with my kids on weekends, and then publish a lot. Like, there's a lot of value in looking around and sort of examining other people's careers to identify what is it that kind of you would identify with.
There was, so many great pearls coming out of that. I think, one of the things I really liked was this idea of just reinventing yourself every 5 years, or just being okay with the fact that, just like sometimes we may do a project and you may realize it's not the right fit, sometimes our niche isn't the right fit. We grow, we learn, we evolve as human beings. And the more that we accept that it's okay to adjust your niche or change it, the more we'll be happy long-term. It's maybe that it's something external. Maybe it's, you know, COVID-19 research 10 years from now, or maybe it's something that is just internal and you say, you know what, I'm no longer interested in this arena. And I think that's where it's even really helpful to have, you know, Lori's suggestion there of having this ordinal list and saying, I do these things to allow us, it's almost forced introspection to say, okay, here are the different things I look at. You know what, item number three is actually really important. You'll be able to elevate that up. Or I've been doing a lot of projects that are spread out really thin. I need to identify where my trajectory is going. I think that there's so many opportunities there to kind of just reflect back and figure out where you are and be okay with that. That may change. I agree. I think that there's not necessarily a set number, and I think it's going to vary by the person. Some people want more, some people want less niches, but I think it's looking at your story, regardless of how you do it, is what's your story? Does it align with something you like doing? Is this getting you to where you want to be, to be personally, professionally happy? Now, one of the other areas kind of moving forward to a little bit of a different direction is doing successful studies. This is early in the year. We have a lot of, you know, residents, fellows, faculty who are thinking about projects over the next year or longer. And I think one of the first things that I know I struggled with early on was, what is a successful project? How do you identify the ones that are going to be successful or the ones that are less likely to be so? So what's your approach to identifying if you think a study is going to be successful?
So one thing that's worked well for me is just to piggyback on some of my really established mentors or PIs. And I've essentially, you know, convinced them to some extent to consider adding like an aim or a sub aim to their third R01, right? And they've been kind of open to that idea, and that's allowed me to gain some like percent effort or protected time to then develop my own kind of career and my like, you know, success as a researcher. But I do think that in order to identify that successful study, you have to first make sure it does align with your goals and interests, right? Going back to everything that we've kind of said, making sure that there's alignment between you and your mentors or this person that you want to kind of piggyback on. So I think that's kind of what's worked for me.
So what I would add is, I guess I'm a little more... So when I think about studies that are going to be successful, I also think about what resources do I have at my institution. You know, if I'm, you know, in Boston, you know, I see a lot of patients who have, you know, sickle cell disease, but I hardly see any that have, you know, some other disease processes that might be specific to, say, like the Pacific Northwest. So, you know, thinking about what's something that you see a ton of, making sure that you have the proper resources to be successful. So making sure that you have a mentor or someone who can advise you about how to go about and be, you know, make those steps. And then also making sure that it's a study question that someone's going to care about once you're done. Unfortunately, positive studies or studies with positive outcomes are much more likely to get published. So if you can pick a project that you know you're already going to find a positive outcome based on your experience, or something that you think is likely to add to the literature in an area that has you know, something that's missing, particularly like in ultrasound now that focuses on like outcomes or improved care or metrics, you know, things that are particularly timely will help to, you know, make that study more publishable and lead to a, you know, an outcome that, you know, you probably started on, and then making sure that you meet deadlines to be able to progress to that. So if you only have a year of fellowship, that's a lot of buy down time. Or, you know, if you're a new faculty and you're already spread really thin, you know, and you want to make sure that you're advancing your career, meeting those steps are all aspects of being successful in the end.
I want to answer this question with like all of the ways that I have gone wrong and say what not to do, but I'll try and frame them in a positive way. So one, though, early on, set your aims very reasonably. Don't shoot for the stars with your first project, and then don't do it all alone. You pairing up pairing up with somebody that has an established track record and being willing to be their boots on the ground, their get stuff done person, is insanely valuable for your CV and your own education. And then also don't give up on it. It's super important to just, you know, follow it through the finish line, even if it's a decade late. I mean, it's, you gotta put the time in, you gotta follow it up. I don't recommend doing a decade late. Don't do that. Last but not least, the time spent vetting your idea is among the most valuable time spent. And I think as a young researcher, I did not have the foresight to see where my studies were going to go wrong until I hit them midstream. And that's the worst time to hit a problem, because then you have to stop and rethink, and it really puts you behind. So adequate vetting of your idea and really thinking through, you know, what does this piece of data mean and what am I going to do with it at the end? And how am I going to collect that? And how am I going to code that? And getting all of those, what seems like inane details, ironed out those are some of the biggest ways in which I've gone wrong.
Yeah, I think that the number of studies I've failed at, my kind of CV of failures well outnumbers my CV of successful projects, but you learn from every single one of those. And I think that y'all hit so many amazing points. I think one of it, you know, just don't do it alone. Identify your collaborators and mentors. We teach medicine in an apprenticeship model where you kind of go through this graduate responsibility, and research follows a similar roadmap. If you try to jump in a project all alone, it doesn't matter how much you write, if you don't have the experience of doing it, it's going to be difficult and likely unsuccessful, and you miss the opportunity to really learn and grow. I like Joe's point too of, you know, what are your resources? Think about where you're at. What is your population? What's the infrastructure? Is it something that requires, you know, one of my first projects was a study where it probably needed at least 40 to 80 hours a week of RAs, and we had no RAs. So it was me going to enroll. And obviously when I did as a resident, that was not conducive to good enrollment. But not knowing what your resources are, because not every study can be done in each environment, even if you have everything else in place. So what do you have there? What is your availability? Are you, you know, if it's a fellowship here, do you have that time set aside? Can you get it done in that time period? Are you going to be staying at your institution long-term, considering all those components that go into the study? I think also the idea of looking for that gap in the literature. I'm a huge proponent of doing a really good literature search. I know that that's an area where it's really easy to kind of shorten up and be like, okay, this site's awesome. I did Google search. I didn't find the first 10 hits, so I know I'm okay. And then what ends up happening is you miss the study that's been done very similarly. And then you don't have your gap. You don't have your novelty. And even if it's positive, it's been done before, you're going to face that same challenge. So identify it's been done before. Maybe look through the limitations and then address that gap. You don't have to be the one that revolutionizes how we treat, you know, targeted temperature management. But you could be one who finds out some micro niches in there that still need to be solved out. So it doesn't have to be the big New England Journal paper, but you need to find the niche of something that hasn't been addressed. And a lot of times the limitations will be a great guide to that. And I think the last one, you know, vetting your ideas and just having that friendly fire team, a mentor, other people, friends, colleagues, someone can just look at that and be like, you're not seeing this aspect or the so what factor. This matters to you, but does this matter to the bigger application? The what's the so what, and even just forcing you to be able to explicitly say that.
I just wanted to add that I think Lori's point about vetting is, I can't emphasize that more. Like, that is so critical and important to be successful. And I think early on, one way to kind of maybe work around that, or not work around it, but to like make that possible, is to use registries or other databases that allow you to submit proposals, because that forces you to come up with your game plan. That forces you to think about, yeah, what is all of the details of the inclusion, exclusion criteria, and all of the details of the statistical plan. And some of these databases and registries also provide statistical support. So early on in your career, I think there are lots of options out there to try to like build your niche by asking your research question within a database.
I think that that's another really, really great point. And just even sometimes getting those words on paper and really thinking through all the kind of gaps, it seems really easy to talk it through. But then when you put it on paper, you realize there's some areas that hadn't considered or just ways to make it, you know, more statistically rigorous. And I see that, you know, Rosemary also put in a great point about, you know, having statistical analysis plan, statistical help, if this is not an area you're comfortable with, or even if it is, it's good to involve a statistician to make sure that you're being the most rigorous and thoughtful about the analytic plan. And so this actually leads us nicely to the next thing, which is once you come up with a study, how do you run your teams? What are your pearls and pitfalls for project management?
I can say off the bat, I think early on, I learned the hard way, like most of us usually do, about having that authorship discussion, right? Talking about what the authorship sequence is going to be and kind of what the roles of each of your co-authors is going to be, I think is super important and is a pitfall that I think we commonly fall into. And you can, it's an awkward conversation. So you can say, hey, listen, my mentors have recommended that we discuss the authorship sequence. It's not just like, it doesn't seem like you're the only one that wants to bring this up. And you can frame it that way and kind of have that discussion. I think assigning tasks to your co-authors early on in any project is super important. And then I think just in terms of moving the project along, right? Sometimes you're deep into this and things aren't moving at a snail's pace, but you've got so many questions. And sometimes what I've ended up doing is, okay, let me get my third draft together and put all of these comments and then I'll send it out to all my co-authors. What ends up happening on the other end is it's so daunting for your co-authors to read your 3,000 word manuscript with all these multiple questions. And I think I've learned that it's better to keep it piecemeal. So you have one particular question that's arise, literally copying, pasting that in an email, not even as an attachment, so that they can just open the email, read it, and provide you the feedback that you need. And it, you have a better chance of getting responses quicker and I think making more headway. So I think those are a few of the pearls that come to mind.
I agree. I think the authorship discussion is really important to have happen early. For academic advancement, it's good to know what your institution focuses on as well. For example, where I am, and I think at most places, first and last author generally are the most important. And then anything in between doesn't really have too much of additional difference in how that promotes you. And then if you set out like guidelines for each person and what they're expected to contribute, and then they don't meet those deadlines, making sure that they understand that authorship could change based on them not meeting deadlines or moving them from the paper, if they don't, you know, contribute enough to be authorship requirements, which can again be hard to do, but sometimes necessary, depending on how things go. Most oftentimes, you know, your mentor is going to be the last author, you'll be the first author, and then, you know, you can have more of a discussion with the other authors based on what they think is reasonable and expected as well.
One of the things that I found helpful for the pertaining to this last question, in my experience, was to have a plan, to have a plan for the project, which is like sounds very silly, but you'd be surprised how many people start a project and they're like all the way up to say writing an IRB, and they don't have a full project proposal yet. Or they're even worse, enrolling patients, and they don't have a full project proposal. And you might say, well, like what is it? Like, what's the problem with that? The problem, just like Mike mentioned, is that you are very likely to miss something that is critical. Critical, for instance, you didn't see that other big study that was negative, that was asking the same question that you asked, or you missed other studies that shed the light on methodology problems that you would have had the opportunity to design and sort of help inform your design had you seen those. And so I was very fortunate that doing residency, I wrote a grant for like a foundation grant. And in the process of writing that grant with a very good mentor, who is actually a remote mentor, That mentor said, just write this grant because it's going to be a really good process for you. And I remember those words, like he said, it's going to be a really good process. And I remember then having completed the study and I published this, the actual work, kind of reflecting back, he was completely right. The process had been the most valuable thing, even more so than the actual publication. And what was the process? The process was just going through the kind of, you know, pains of writing a grant, which at the time was incredibly difficult and sort of foreign, but that gave me the idea or made me understand that kind of the value of having a structure and sort of following a recipe, just like when you're going to cook. And just like with everything in life, the more skills you have, I think the more you can afford not have a recipe at hand. You can just, you know, kind of fly or get things on the fly. When you're more inexperienced, I think it is even more helpful and more important to have a very specific kind of roadmap. So as a fellow, you should start your project with a specific aims page that starts with a title and then has a background section. A background section that you write before you start discussing your project with, say, your mentors, you write that paragraph that sort of puts together the, you know, what's known, what other people have done, and kind of makes very clear what is that knowledge gap that Mike was talking about. And then you mention or make very specific what are your specific aims. And each of those specific aims should have a hypothesis and should have then a methodology to kind of follow them. And it's only after that that you go out and try to enroll patients or get an IRB, because I feel like 5 or 6 versions of that initial proposal will change before you get to what I think would be then either a viable project and even more so a good project. So critical lesson for me was the importance of having that specific aims page, whether you're writing an NIH grant or you're just doing your first project as a fellow or as a resident. I think the value will be the same.
Yeah, I love all those points. The first one being, you know, that there's the authorship discussions are so key. It always feels a little awkward in the beginning and it gets easier with time, but I've never regretted having that conversation early. I've almost always regretted having that at the end when you're trying to do it, because you can always revisit, right? You can say, here's the theoretical list. Here's what we're planning on. And then, you know what, actually so-and-so did a really amazing job. And I think they should actually elevate it to that. Or maybe they, you know, actually did more than that and they should be the first author, right? But you can always adjust that, but it's much more difficult not knowing that at the onset. Felipe's point on structure is key. Having that structure, having an infrastructure of what you need to put in there, just makes everything easier. I have a Word document that I copy and paste every time for a study, and then I don't have to reinvent the wheel. When I start with new groups, they can just plug and play into there. That's more, it's more of a Google Doc actually, but they can just plug and play directly into that. So they don't have to, we don't have to reinvent anything, and everyone knows exactly what sections fit there. And that kind of leads into the other piece, which is identifying your tasks. Think about when you see a really effective resuscitation, everyone has a clear role. You have a compressor, you have the charting person, you have the person at the head of the bed, you have the proceduralist, everyone has a role and works really well. But if everyone's kind of unclear who's doing what, people start duplicating efforts and a bunch of people are staying around not sure what to do. And so I think a paper follows that same thing. You have tasks, everyone's clear what their role is and they have deadlines and you check in with them. And I think finally, the last thing kind of being there just is, you know, have something that people can work on. Don't bolus to the end. You can have a running email. You can have a Google Doc, but just have something that people can work asynchronously in real time. And so with a couple minutes left, I have one last question for the group. If you could give yourself one piece of advice, your younger self, one piece of advice, what would it be?
I think I would have told myself to be patient, that research is a marathon. It's a different pace from the ED, right? It's slow, it's meticulous, and it's more of a marathon than a sprint.
That was very, oh, sorry, go ahead, Joe.
No, you're up, Laura, go ahead.
That was very similar to mine, because I was gonna say endurance. Like it's all about endurance. And there have been so many times when I would get down on myself and feel like I was needing to sprint, and I would put in all this effort and I would drive myself bonkers and be exhaustified, when a better tact is to every week, every time, sit down and say, what is it that I'm doing this week? And do the slow play, not the sprint. You're very smart.
I would add to that. I totally agree. And I find even sometimes taking a couple weeks and coming back to a manuscript allows me to sort of like clear my head, say, where was I, like, what was the point of this? Why was I talking about this? Did I lose something? How do I narrow my focus and what I want to say? And to Lori's point, like 10 years, you know, like to get that manuscript done, or however long it's been, you know, I don't know, Lori, how long to from start to finish on that manuscript?
2011 to 2021.
Yeah, you know, like,
it's embarrassing though.
But like the fortitude and strength to get that done and not give up is like, it's real. And, you know, I think that that's an excellent example, and congratulations, because, you know, a lot of people don't pick things up, and that's what's going to make you successful. And one of the things I would say is, if it was me going back, is I joined the SAM grants committee, and reviewing other grants has been really helpful for me, looking at other people's ideas and just sitting in a room with other people critiquing and thinking about those ideas really helped me to approach my ideas a little bit better, and then also get like feedback about you know, what I want to do and move in the right direction. So that's what I would say, and sorry to overrun.
I think for me, probably the one thing that I would tell the younger version of myself is to just give myself more time early on to think about the things that I enjoy doing. Some of the kind of most game-changing interventions that I've done in my life later on in my career have had a lot to do with having a just better idea of what are the things that I genuinely feel kind of happy about and happy with. What are the things within my professional realm that I feel fulfilled, that I feel that sort of, you know, intrinsic motivation. Everything eventually kind of falls in place, and you learn by, you know, trial and error, and you spend some time doing projects that you hate, and you get involved in things that you lament. And so I think some of that could be avoided, some of that suffering could be avoided if you spend a lot of time upfront, or just like some time, kind of make it deliberate as a process. Just like, I don't know, everyone is supposed to think about, you know, themselves in college and kind of, you know, that their role in the world. I'm not sure that everybody does that, but that's I guess what people aspire to do in college. Similarly, I think early on in fellowship and residency, I think it's good to just reflect and be very critical about you know, I want to be a researcher, but like, do I enjoy writing? Do I enjoy spending time analyzing data? I want to be a medical educator. Do I enjoy bedside teaching, remediation? Do I enjoy, you know, whatever it is? I think that would be very helpful for me to avoid some suffering.
So many amazing points there. Thank you to our amazing panelists. I know that I learned a ton from each of you. Please, for anyone who's listening to this, reach out to us, let us know what can be useful. As a reminder, we have two upcoming sessions, November 11th, Breaking Down Study Designs, Pros, Cons, and Common Flaws. And then February 17th, we have From Idea to Publication, Strategies for Publishing and Navigating the Peer Review System. And with that, I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight, and talk to y'all soon.